Welcome to the Blazing Ember podcast, where we aim to amplify the voices of Latino professionals. We, Diana and Maria, founded this podcast to explore unspoken rules and all the ships, leadership, mentorship, sponsorship, and allyship with Latino leaders.
We are here to ignite your path to success with valuable insights. Bienvenidos.
Hello and welcome back. Today, we're talking to Dania Hernandez, most commonly known to her students as Professor Hernandez. Professor Hernandez is the Archibald R. Murray Professor of Law at Fordham Law, where she teaches anti-discrimination law, comparative employment discrimination, critical race theory, and we're going to get into all of these topics shortly, the science of implicit bias and the law, new pathways to social justice, and then she teaches trust in estates, trust in will. So we'll talk about that as well. And I love that it's just a wide array of things that are so critical to our people, to the society and sort of social order, especially today, given kind of some of the attacks that we're seeing on DEI. You received your AB from Brown University, JD from Yale, where you served as a notes topic editor of the Yale Law Journal. And people, there is more. This woman has done quite a bit and is amazing. Professor Hernandez is an internationally recognized comparative law expert and Fulbright scholar who has visited the, I'm not going to be able to say this.
I'm going to try. Can I try, Maria?
You try.
Okay. I think it's Université Paris-Ouest-Nanterre-La-Défense.
That's pretty good. In Paris. And then of the West Indies Law School in Trinidad. She's also been a fellow at Princeton, Rutgers, and the Fred T. Korematsu Center for Law and Equity, and a scholar in residence at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about your work, and several books that you've published have been on comparative race relations and anti-discrimination laws. And we have you so that we can talk about your most current book, which was published by Beacon Press, and it's called Racial Innocence, Unmasking Latino Anti-Black Bias and the Struggle for Equality. So thank you so much for joining us, Professor.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Thanks.
Go ahead, Maria.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, before we get into the book, because there's so much there in Professor Hernandez's career, I'd love to hear more just to tell us about, like, you know, who you were before you started publishing and doing all these great things, like in as a student. And how did you become a student at Yale? And how did you work your way to where you are now?
Well, you know, it was an indirect path. I hadn't foreseen this direction in my life. I grew up in New York City, and I was fortunate enough to receive scholarships. Back then, it was called an ABC, a Better Chance Program, a scholarship for prep school. And I was very fortunate that back then, that program had just opened up to what they call day schools, meaning I could sleep at home and still go to school during the day. And before that, the program had been mostly about placing students in boarding schools, your Exeters, your Choate Roadman, your Choates, that sort of thing. And my immigrant mother was like, none of that. And they're sleeping under my roof. And so luckily the program had spaces in these day schools. So I go off to the Upper East Side of Manhattan, the Nightingale Bamford School for Girls. And that opens up a whole new world for me. College is, you know, much more attainable and what have you. But I go off to college after the prep school, go to Brown University. And even though, you know, the curriculum was wide open and, you know, there were so many paths to pursue, I had myself, you know, sometimes you're your own worst enemy. I thought I needed to have a profession or job that would show to the world that, you know, that I was a college graduate and that I could pay bills. And so I had this notion, right, you know, that meant I had to be in business. What about business? I don't know, but business. When I had to be, you know, and so I look around, but you know, none of these things really fit with what my actual passions are for social justice and helping people. And so the best thing I can find that where they'll let me in the door is a management training program at Bloomingdale's. So, you know, Maine, okay. Retail establishment back on the Upper East Side. Yeah. And what I discovered is that although I love to shop, I was not a very good executive, let alone executive in training. And that what I really wanted was to be able to read and analyze and talk to people about ideas, you know, other than how to merchandise and you know, best market, you know, product lines. So that brings me to the last available job that there was as a paralegal. Mm-hmm. I had no notion of myself as a pre-law lawyer, none of this. But I ended up at a law firm because that's where the job was. And it was a patent law firm, which meant that all the attorneys either were biochemical engineers in undergrad, you know, biology, chemistry, et cetera. You know, they were all what we would call STEM today. And so, you know, it's a very particular kind of mindset in addition to them being a lawyer. But what I discovered was that I loved it, that even though it wasn't necessarily within sort of a thematic research area that would be my passion, I still liked that life, the life of the mind, the reading, helping, even if it was like, you know, high powered clients like DuPont, but it's still, right? It's an idea of like, how do you take your intellectual skills to be of assistance in the world? And so with that, I applied to Yale and to other law schools, and I managed to get a very significant aid package at Yale Law School. So they were the ones in where I enrolled. And that from there, it was just a whole journey of exploration. And I stopped with this idea that I had to fit sort of what a first generation person thought of as success. Because I'd seen that that didn't, you know, that wasn't something, a way of thinking about moving in the world that was of use to me. And I was also benefited that at that time, Yale was one of the earlier schools that hit loan forgiveness if you did public interest. And so that was like a huge weight off my shoulders that I could just really pursue whatever I wanted to pursue. And it was during a time when the market was not what it is today. And so there was an ability to ask not only, you know, to be hired over the summer, but to have split summers so that, you know, I'd maximize the entire summer, but with two jobs rather than just one. So, you know, so I worked for the New York District Attorney's Office, but then I also worked for Death Penalty Organization down south. I worked for Puerto Rican Legal Defense Fund, but I also took on a summer job in a law firm out in San Francisco, but you know, I wanted to see what law firm like was like. So I mean, all of which is to say, like, I explored lots of different things. And what I ultimately end up doing is after law school, after a clerkship in Puerto Rico with a federal judge, after a fellowship, doing sort of large civil rights impact litigation for the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy. Then I'm like, finally, okay, what's going to be my first big job? And my first big job that I'm very excited to get was working as a staff attorney for the HIV unit of Brooklyn Legal Services. And what was fascinating there is that unlike so many other legal services offices, because our clients, and this is back in the 90s, you know, when AIDS was a death sentence, we didn't have the drugs that we have today, right, to prolong someone's life. And so you knew, like, you know, that there was a timetable. And so you weren't going to have your very sick clients running all over to meet with a different lawyer for their housing issue, a different lawyer for their custody disputes regarding, you know, visitation with their children, because so many of them had had their parental rights terminated, let alone go to a separate administrative court hearing for their financial benefits from Social Security and the like that, you know, they constantly had to be litigated. And there was also a need in beyond being a generalist in that way, which I loved. I love this idea that I wouldn't just be doing one thing. I'd be in housing court one day. I'd be arguing with the Bureau of Welfare Rights in another. You know, there'd be this variety of what the job would be like. But they also needed a staff attorney dedicated to doing emergency wills. Because even though our clientele were of limited means, you know, the wills are also about telling the world what your child rearing preferences are.
Yeah.
And even the small amount of money you have or the possessions you have, they may not seem like, you know, what Bill Gates level, but they were meaningful to you and your family. And so getting that in writing is also part of a healing process in some ways, you know, sort of kind of coming to terms with the ultimate in your mortality, and also having some sense of closure about exiting with dignity by doing this through the wills. I mean, I learned so much from my clients. And so that was what I was doing. And my supervising attorneys were very much about like liking the work product, but finding that I would go on for a bit in my writing. You know, meaning, tell you, this is a motion practice. The judge does not want to see you go into the philosophical reasons for X, Y, and Z. You know, we have a page limit here. This looks much more like a law review article than it does, you know, just a motion. And so, you know, what that was sort of a signal to me was that I love doing this work. I thought it was very important work. It was difficult to watch clients die on you. And what I really wanted to do was talk about these things in a huge societal perspective of what my clients were experiencing, which is really the life of the mind, right? It's scholarly work. And doing a full-time job as a lawyer doesn't really give you the luxury to do that. And so I said, okay, where will I get paid to be able to write like this? It's like, a law professor. And so it was sort of, again, another indirect route into a world I had never considered before, of turning to law teaching as a means to be able to talk about large societal issues in writing, in the place that would value it. And then I was just fortunate. And I say fortunate because nobody really asks you these questions. It's a shame of our profession that nobody says, what kind of teaching experience do you have? Are you, you know, do you think what shows us that you have a particular skill set for teaching? Those questions do not come up. It's all about, what are you writing? What have you written before, et cetera? So it turns out that I find that it's sort of another kind of a vocation to be able to teach. I love the teaching piece as well. It feeds the scholarship feeds the teaching. You know, it's all kind of one ecosystem for me. But again, that was sort of a happy discovery. I had no idea that that was going to, you know, to be the case. And so it was a long sort of answer to your question, but it's a way in which I want to be able for any of the young listeners or, you know, a young aspiring attorneys in the room to sort of know that there's no one way to do this. And also that sometimes you have to kind of follow your intuitions and your passions and let that lead you, as opposed to, you know, what works for some other people, but didn't work for me. This idea of having an image of what you want and you go after it. I kind of like went with the flow and, you know, followed where my interest led me. And unfortunately, that ultimately led to being a tenured law professor at Fordham Law School.
I love that. And thanks so much for going through those details, because when I first started looking at your CV, you know, one of the things that stood out was you have kind of a theme to all of the work that you've been doing. And then I saw the trust and wills kind of work. And I said, that's really interesting, but I didn't know how that piece of the puzzle fit in. And now it makes so much sense now that you've shared that with us. And what I really appreciate about your story is that you were kind of just, it seems like you were motivated by a desire to do something, right? Like you were going to do something. You didn't know what it was going to be in business. You were going to be, you know, maybe it was being a paralegal, but you knew that you wanted to do more with your mind, right? Because you must have felt that creative energy this whole time as you were bouncing around from, not bouncing, right? It's definitely more tactical and methodical than that in certain extent. But, you know, you were going from a position to position, and you were really, you know, trying to seek an outlet for all of the mental energy you had. And I think that that's amazing because, you know, at least I'll say it's very relatable to me, as I never thought I'd have a podcast. And here I am because I had some unfulfilled part of my life. So maybe, Maria, you feel the same.
Yes. So, and I also love the one piece I'll comment on is also that you had someone who said to you, we've had another one of our guests who has said to us, someone in the office sat down and said, is this really what you want to do? Because I see this disconnect, right? And so I love that piece of it. And then, so I'm going to talk about numbers because it's kind of dismal, the numbers for Latino lawyers generally, right? So we look at the population, we have come up to 5.8% of the legal population. And that is frankly, probably 1.8% higher than when I went to law school a long time ago. But Latinas are still 2%. And we have not grown, right? And so then you look at Latino professors, and you know, I struggle to find recent stats. And I know that Michael Olivas, who was from Texas, Houston, was kind of the, you know, he was the godfather of the Latino professors, right? And he, unfortunately for our listeners, he passed. But he was quite a character and quite an interesting person and someone who really wanted to make a difference. And so what we had was 10 years ago, the number of tenured law professors was around 4%. I found something from Seattle University that said it was 5%, but it doesn't have the distinction of whether it's tenured or not tenured. So I'm just going to ask, you know, given those stats, right? So you're coming to Fordham, you are part of this 4% of the professors. What did that feel like, as well as being a woman, right? And kind of what was your experience? And talk a little bit about how that also added to the work that you are doing now.
Well, you know, I was incredibly fortunate because my very first job, a Latina hired me. I was at St. John's. I mean, I don't know if anyone else has this kind of a story. I mean, that's how much of an outlier the whole thing was. I applied, you know, to a number of places, but my heart was in New York. That's where my family is. And St. John's University School of Law, located out in Queens, had what I think its first Latina tenured law professor was Berta Hernandez Turiol, a Cubana who had been raised in Puerto Rico and who was doing amazing, interesting work very at the very beginning of what was sort of Latino studies or what LatCrit. And so she was a mentor and she was incredible and is incredible, you know, till today. I consider like a madrina, how wonderful she was to me. So, you know, she could see like a diamond in the rough. and you know, was instrumental in having me be hired and also mentoring me along the way, you know, sort of like this you don't do, this you do do, right? You know, in ways that you don't have any real facility unless that's your world, right? Or if others see themselves in you. And typically that's not what the Latina young professional experiences, but I had that in her. And, you know, it's been it's one of those investments when someone invests in you that early. It's one of these investments that sort of continually incurs dividends, right? You know, the return on the investment is just huge. And so I really feel for other people who have not been able to enter into the profession in this kind of way. Because that being said, you know, there are challenges to your authority at all turns. You know, and if you're not sort of firmly planted with a sense of like what you're doing has value, your different way of looking at it has value, you can shake, right? So meaning I came into law teaching with other people of color and they didn't all make it through, right? They were instead part of what maybe we would call attrition, right? They did not survive I don't know what to call it, a boot camp, but you know, the early years of on the tenure track is not just simply trying to get it together to do writing in order to, you know, as they say, publish or perish, right? But it's also surviving the internal politics of your institution, of your profession, and of the student body. Right? You know, they look at you and they do not see law professor. And so it was, you know, luck of the draw, but what a luck, right? To be able to have her right there. The other thing that I've seen over time, and I think it's such a beautiful thing, are these identity support groups, right? And so one of them, I had a chance to be part of just this past year, a gathering called Law Tina. So Latinas in law, a Law Tina. And they gather every year. And I went to a recent gathering in San Antonio, Texas. And it was wonderful, right? Because they bring together both law interested people. Right? So, you know, law students. To be, right? Undergrads and maybe some high school students, along with new law teachers, new legal professionals, judges, right? So all of us in the same room, giving all different kinds of panels to try to give one another sort of nurturance and guidance and what have you. And so those identity, or I guess what we would call affinity groups, as they are in law firms and right, in the corporate sector, right? These spaces for affinity groups are really sort of key to survival.
Yeah, no, I could see that. And actually, I spoke to the young woman who started Latina a few years ago, and she just was gangbusters. I mean, so I'm glad to hear she continued it. So I'm going to turn a little bit to kind of institutional racism and critical race, right, which is kind of the topics of your books. These are very charged topics, right? And so if you think about, I was in Houston for several years. I was there until 2022 when I came back to New York. And I, some of the stories, but, you know, we had parents of elementary school students who would say, they're teaching my kid critical race theory. And you would say, what do you mean by they're teaching your child critical race theory? And they would say, well, you know, they're doing this social emotional learning stuff. And I would say, but that's about empathy and, you know, being able to express yourself. That's not critical race theory. I was like, that's what I taught in law school. And then they would talk about, you know, brainwashing the children with wokeness. So talk about, you know, your scholarly work and what you have done over time to kind of deal with these topics.
Well, I was introduced to critical race theory early in law school because I was life of luck, right? I was fortunate that one of the sort of early innovators was part of the Yale Law School faculty, a man named Harlan Dalton. And so he was going to these gatherings, bringing back the emerging literature. And so I was sort of reading it sort of off mimeograph, like date yourself. And for me, and I see it with my students even today, right, that introduction to critical race theory was sort of foundational for me to really think about the ways in which I contribute, meaning that without it, I don't quite know how long I would have stuck at this lawyering, to be totally honest, right? So what is it? Because so often people have a misinformed idea. You know, when Saturday Night Live does skits about it, right? It's very amusing, right? But no one comes away with any more sort of illumination, you know, about what it is. It's essentially just an analytical lens, right, that developed within law schools, right, for thinking about the ways in which, you know, how do we understand so much continuing racial violence, so much racial disparity in access to education and all other public goods? How do we understand that so many decades after the civil rights movement, if it's not about putting up a whites only sign, right, then what is it, right? Because we've taken down the signs, why are there still disparities? Right. Critical race theory is about looking at how ongoing systems and structures sort of create institutional barriers that then continue on with these legacies, right, of Jim Crow segregation, of even of slavery, right, and the logics of it, that this is what we need to be looking at, as opposed to who is the Nazi person in the room who's not letting anyone apply for this job. Such individuals may still exist, right, but they are not really the ones who are responsible for huge disparities in the school to pipeline, the school prison to pipeline, right? But that's about institutional structures, right? Systems and structures. And so this is what critical race theory offers. It's this analytical, it's a lens within which to look at these problems and want to find solutions that will actually be effective, as opposed to constantly an old civil rights frame of looking at who's the bad person in the room with the bad mindset, who's thinking bad thoughts to do bad things, right? You're sort of a criminal law individual, a perpetrator kind of mindset. Critical race theory is the curative to that.
So if we have a lack of knowledge of critical race theory, and I'll say I'm one of those people, to be honest, right, is that I learned anything about race either, one, because I've lived it, right, lived experiences, not just of myself, but lived experiences of others, heard stories. And and really just reports and stuff that I get through average media. What is the impact of having that knowledge? Like what does that do to your lens, as you mentioned? Why is that view important?
Well, I mean, I'll give you like a little quick kind of an example that I experienced, which outside of law school, just talking with an average citizen, as we say, right?
Non-lawyer?
A non-lawyer to my knowledge. I think it was a florist. So okay. I lived in Harlem, and there was a next door neighbor who had an individual doing sort of cleaning up. Like he was sweeping and hosing down the front and watering the plants. And I said, oh, that's very nice of you to do that. And he said, yes, you know, because here I have to do this because if I don't do it, then it just stays dirty. And, you know, it's not like downtown, meaning, you know, the Upper East Side, that it's not like downtown where things are so pristine, et cetera, like implying, like, you know, those white people and those rich white people, they clean up after themselves, but not this community of color. Right? And so I paused and I said to him, I said, you know, have you ever thought about the ways in which when you're on the Upper East Side, there is a much more extensive garbage pickup that systemically, right? The garbage gets picked up there more often. The clean sweepers come more often. And that within these communities of color, that we have a higher density population. Many more of us live on top of each other. and so we have many more people and less garbage service. So even if every individual is absolutely pristine, you would still have this problem, right? That's a systemic problem. It's like, oh, I never thought of it that way. That's what critical race theory enables, right? I never thought of it that way. And once you don't think of it that way, what do you have? You now have an ability to think of processing and resolving an issue, garbage in the street, right? In a way you did not before. Without critical race theory, what people are often defaulting to, right, is, oh, it's about your culture. It's about your bad habits as an individual that cause this problem. Right. And so meaning you need to do better. Right. That's all this individual perspective. When you look at things through a critical race theory lens, you have that as a tool of analysis. What that empowers you to be able to see, right, is that it's not about the deficiencies of the individual. Right. It's about societal systems and structures, which we can do something about. Right? Meaning if I was king for the world or, you know, a queen for the day, right, I would be able then to enable the rat czar, right, of New York City, right, to talk to her about, hey, let's get more garbage pickup over here. That would help resolve our rat problem uptown in phenomenal ways.
So don't give us the rats uptown, right?
Exactly. I mean, even if you gave us the same exact garbage pickup, it would not be enough because we have many more people living all on top of each other, right? So that's what critical race theory offers up. A way to actually see to the heart of a problem without presuming it's always about the deficiencies, the cultural, racial, ethnic deficiencies of individuals, which gets you nowhere, right? Either you think about ethnic cleansing as a solution. Oh, they're a bad race or a culture, so then let's just get rid of them. Or you think about it as systems and structures and you change the way in which you have policies, right? And rules and regulations that could enable a different kind of outcome.
So this is like really being able to unpack, you know, a very superficial cause and effect kind of analysis into something that goes much deeper into systemic problems. And I say that as I'm being schooled literally by the professor on critical race theory. But I'm intrigued and wondering when I can listen to one of your classes.
I think we need to sit in one of them.
Yeah, but let's get to this gets even, I guess, more interesting as we go into your book. So let's talk about that next, because we're going to run out of time for sure.
So your book has race, ethnicity, skin color, right? How it impacts community of colors, specifically Latinos, right? And how do you view yourself and how do you discriminate against each other, despite the fact that, you know, we're technically the same group, right? We're all Latinos. So you really focus on Latinos are kind of fooling themselves if they think that they're not prejudiced, if they think that they don't also carry bias, right? And that bias is going to differ. It's a spectrum, right? But there's a bias. So why that topic? And a little bit of what have you gotten back from your listeners? Like, what's the feedback on discussing that topic?
Well, to answer the first part of the question, so like, you know, how do I come to this topic? Right. It happened in a very sort of organic way. First, I was doing just some research on employment discrimination. I teach employment discrimination. And so I'm looking at new and interesting cases to talk to my students about. And I started to see this peculiar phenomenon, right? Not a huge trend, but a number of cases where if it was a Latino saying I was discriminated against by another Latino, and it was about race. I'm dark skin, they're light skin. I'm from Cuba, they're from Argentina. And that's a racial dynamic. This is what the claimant is saying, right? Courts all of a sudden thought that civil rights law did not apply. What I was seeing was like judges, and if it was a jury trial, the same, thinking, oh, something might not be fair here, but it's not about race, right? Because these Latinos, that's something different. They don't have race within them, right? Either the idea is that we're all mestizo, right? That we're all racially mixed. So who can tell who? So there can't be any race problems. Or this race is when a white English-speaking American, U.S. citizen discriminates against an English-speaking African-American. That is racism, right? But everything else that happens, that's a cultural misunderstanding, or if it's intra within Latinos, it's a personality conflict in the workplace. Right? There's always some other reason that the courts were looking at. And I thought, well, this is very peculiar. In many ways, what this is doing is saying there's an off-ramp, right, to anti-discrimination law. If you are a Latino, and particularly an Afro-Latino, claim it. So then I thought, well, is this going on in other areas? Is it just employment? And so I started to look at housing discrimination, public accommodations, right? Educational school settings, criminal justice settings. And what I was discovering is that in each of these spaces where Latinos could have some power, right? They're the school principal, they're a corrections officer in a jail, right? Meaning white supremacy still exists, right? But that doesn't mean that Latinos don't have spaces in which we are the face of power and in which we have discretion over others. And if anything, in some spaces, it's even sort of disproportionate power. Like if you think about housing, given how significant housing discrimination is, it typically means then that a Latino is looking to another Latino for a place to live because other spaces are not open to them. Right. So given hypersegregation, it means that Latinos have a great deal of power to discriminate against other Latinos. And so I was seeing these same dynamics of, oh, judges and juries don't think regular anti-discrimination law applies, even though anti-discrimination law says nowhere in statutes or case law, this is only for certain populations. It's not for anyone who's saying they've experienced a problematic action that was not based on merit, right? So meaning the law is for all of us. So that's what inspired the book, that I wanted to be able to provide a corrective in those legal cases, but also, and this sort of gets to the second part of your question, contribute to the conversation, right? For many Latinos for whom this was sort of surprising. Like meaning we live in the United States in a context in which we experience ethnic discrimination. Like, you know, before anybody sees my brown skin face, they hear the last name Hernandez. So when I call over a telephone and I say, I'm looking for an apartment, I'm looking for a job, and I have to say Hernandez, and there's a pause, I know what that's about. Right. Meaning I'm about to get something, right? Meaning that there's going to be some kind of exclusion, kind of dynamic that is not going to be pleasant, right? That's just about Hernandez. It's not about skin color or anything else because they haven't seen anything else. We live in that context. Within that context, then, it makes it difficult for many Latinos to also hold at the same, that two things can be true at the same time, that we can be victims of this ethnic, racialized kind of exclusion just by virtue of being Latino. This is true. At the very same time that within Latinidad, within Latino communities, we can also be perpetrators of discrimination and hold racial bias. So as the book came together and I started to talk more about it, you know, do a book event. And I've been blessed in many ways to not only just do them within sort of like the typical scenario, like a bookstore or a conference of fellow lawyers or what have you. I've been invited by many community organizations to come do talks, and I've done them in all different kinds of locations. It's enabled me to travel, or, you know, across the country in ways I wouldn't otherwise have. And what I find time and time again is that the reactions to the book tend to fall into sort of like three kind of, I'll call them buckets, right? One is the Latino who's like, but wait a minute, nobody ever talked to me about Black Latinos. And I don't think about Blackness. You know, we come in different shades, but, you know, I don't think about that as race.
Right? I don't see color.
I see it, but I don't think of it like an American, meaning U.S., North American thinks about it, right? No, we have our own Latino ways of thinking about it. Right? And for that bucket of readers or listeners, because, you know, some people listen to the book as an audiobook, for them, the entire narrative, really, because the book is a collection of people's stories, because I'm trying to sort of lift up the people who have otherwise been excluded, right? You know, from the public discourse. For that reader, it is an entire journey of constant surprise, because it is it's stories from people whom they haven't heard about, right? Meaning Telemundo, Univision, et cetera. These are not the voices that they put forward. Right? And so if it's not part of your schooling, it's not part of the media, where do you get to hear about this? Right? It is literal ignorance. It's not sort of not me being judgy, right? It's like literal ignorance. It's things people have not been exposed to. And certainly lack of any knowledge about Afro-Latino justice movements within Latin America. There's like this disconnect between what's happening, you know, across Las Americas and also our position here as Latinos within the United States. So that's one dynamic. Another is somewhat similar from white Americans who are like, huh, what? I thought you all were people of color. Like, you know, like we think of you all the same. So what is all this? That they don't understand it at all. Right? And then what was really quite fascinating to me, and what took me the most by surprise, though maybe that was my own sort of naivete of thinking of myself as sort of just scholar, right? Is the emotional response that I've gotten from people across the African diaspora, really. You know, it's African-Americans, it's Afro-Latinos, it's West Indians, it's Africans, right? Anyone who has sort of any connection with African ancestry who has recognized a experience of exclusion within the book, right? Either because it directly happened to them or they witnessed it or otherwise it was within their circles, right? And so in those interactions with those readers, it is a moment in which for them, it's the first time they've ever had a space to talk about it. Right? And so it's not your, let's put it this way. It's not your typical book event, right? Meaning, you know, people come up quite emotional. It's a, you know, it's a visceral experience having read the book. They are crying or they are, like we're saying, church testifying. That is to say, they're not asking a question. In footnote two, you said this, and I, you know, instead, it's about the ways in which they felt seen in the book and want to reflect back in the book event about how meaningful it was to have been seen in the book. And I guess because I think of myself sort of just with the head, right? Even though I try to write with the heart, It's still every time it happens to me, it's quite moving to see that that's another layer, right? And then I guess, you know, the very final thing I'll say, of course, are just those Latinos who are like, absolutely not. No, this is, you are wrong. You're wrong. I'll close this out by simply saying, and it was those folks I expected. Them I know, right? I've lived with them. I've grown up with them. This perspective I know well. And so this is why, even though the book is written hopefully in a very accessible way and telling other people's stories, take a little bit of my own story, that sort of thing. So that's not sort of like, as my mom would say, do I need my dictionary to read this one? No, mommy, you do not need the dictionary to read this one, right? You know, this one, you can just read. Not quite like a novel, but still. I do love when people post pictures of themselves reading it on the beach. Some of my fan base does that. But what the book does, though, is it says, okay, here's the story. But for those doubting Tomases in the audience, right? Yeah. Here are all the footnotes. Here is a bibliography. Go read. Here are all the Latinos writing about this. So it was also a way to lift up, as a public service, if you will, the production of knowledge, right, that other Latinos, Latinas have been doing, but who don't get the sort of this kind of public access because they're anthropologists writing in their field, they're sociologists writing in their field. And so unless that's your expertise, you don't see their work, right? Doesn't make it a New York Times bestseller list. Mine didn't either. But in any case, I still wanted to kind of let the world know about those resources that existed, and also the empiricism of it, like meaning that we can count heads, right? We can see statistically the ways in which, unfortunately, within Latino labor markets, because Latinos hire other Latinos, right? We have segregated labor markets as well, particularly if you are, you know, construction worker, working class, et cetera, right? You know, other Latinos may not be hiring us in high powered white collar jobs, but for the majority of us, it's the Latinos who are hiring us. So in these segregated spaces, right, you can document the ways in which skin color makes a difference, right? That we Latinos are not race blind. One last little, you know, example I'll throw out there is one of the researchers who I tried to highlight in the book is this economist who, doing that thing that social scientists do, sort of multivariate variable analysis, so like control for different factors, and they can say, when all these things are equal, this other thing you can see is doing all the work here. She looked at immigrant labor markets, right, where everyone's an immigrant. And what she uncovered was that the thing that controls wages most significantly within the immigrant labor market for Latinos, not skin color, not English proficiency, not prior schooling level, not even citizenship status. You know, all these things that you would sort of intuit, right, would be so significant in the setting of your wages. It is skin color. And this is another fascinating aspect of her research, that it is more predominant within Latino labor markets than with other immigrant labor markets. So, look, you know, where Africans are Africans, you don't see that skin color nonsense. Right? Isn't that interesting?
I was not ready for this lesson. I was grossly underprepared to learn all this stuff right now. And it's, I think this is the type of education we all need, because even when we have good intentions, sometimes having that information is really important, as we were saying earlier, right? So that we can better understand what a possible solution is, right? Because otherwise you're just throwing stuff at the problem, hoping it'll stick and fix something, but it's not really the best approach when you don't dig deep enough. So thank you so much for that. And I'm so glad you did not stay writing trust and wills many years ago and moved on in your life, because we wouldn't have this information without you. So thank you.
Well, I will say that trust and wills is a deep love of mine for writing and for doing, because I do get called in to, you know, still do will stuff. But it's not the space where I do sort of like, I try to make the biggest contribution as far as doing the writing and the research. That is true.
So one of the questions that we always ask as we're wrapping up is to kind of get a sense of, you know, it's called Blazing Ember Podcast, which, as you know, is based on Justice Sotomayor. And I think the question is, what makes your ember blaze? And then what's next for you?
For me, it's the idea of thinking of myself as an activist scholar, right? That meaning that my teaching is about trying to make the world a better place and having other people be, you know, social justice activists in whatever space they find themselves, where it's a law firm, a CEO, wherever they may find themselves. And that this work means also teaching other people to do it well, right? And so the thing that has been really exciting to me recently has been teaching a new class that I call writing, as in writing, writing, I mean like writing wrong. So writing slash writing. It would be easier if it was in Spanish. But in any case, in English, it's sort of like more explaining than if I'm saying it rather than you reading it. So writing race in the public sphere. And in that class, what I do is I walk my students through what it means to write in short form, not long law review articles, not motion practice, but where you're trying to influence the public mindset, because that's part of your lawyering as well, right? Mm-hmm. Things are not going to land the same way in a jury trial if you've got jurors who don't understand certain aspects of society, right? Same thing with anything else you do within your transactional work, right? Meaning educating people matters. So in that space, what excites me is to see how much it's meaningful for students to have critical race theory as an analytical lens, and then to be able to claim their voice, their authentic voices, for trying to make a difference in the world, right? That is something that excites me very much. And it's a way I try to kind of sort of carry on the torch in doing it in the classroom as well.
Love it. Love it. Well, thank you so much. Really, we're pleased to have Professor Tania Hernandez as our speaker for this session. Please, please, please go listen to us. Obviously, listen to the podcast. But more importantly, we have to ask you to please purchase her book. So I'm going to repeat it. It is Racial Innocence, Unmasking Latino Anti-Black Bias, and the Struggle for Equality. And you can find it anywhere you buy your books, including Amazon, which will deliver it by the next day. So please purchase her book. And gracias, muchas gracias for being with us here today.
Diana Maria, one last thing I wanted to just put out there. The Spanish version of the book will be coming out August 2024.
Oh, that's so awesome. Yeah. Okay, and español también. So
I'm excited you said that, because I have a couple of people within my family circle that I'd love to deliver maybe autographed copies to prove the points that I've been making for a long time, you know, through experience and stuff. So this is awesome. Thank you for letting us know that.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Blazing Ember podcast and our journey to empowerment. Look out for more episodes to keep your ember blazing.
Visit blazingember.com, where you can connect with us and share your feedback. Hasta pronto.